It's Tuesday, February 18, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Where does religious liberty intersect and sometimes collide with the business world? That is no longer just a hypothetical issue. It's a very live and a very urgent issue in several states, having to do especially with the issue of same-sex marriage. For instance, in states including New Mexico and Oregon and Washington, you have people who are florists and cake bakers and those who are photographers at weddings who are now finding themselves on the wrong side of discrimination judgments because they have refused, on the basis of their Christian convictions, to participate in same-sex marriages, ceremonies, and observances. Should it be lawful for a Christian photographer, or one who makes wedding cakes, or for that matter, also a florist, to refuse to serve a same-sex couple when it comes to their marriage or ceremony? It's a very interesting question, and it harkens to the fact that the Christian worldview reminds us that when Christians enter into the public space, especially when we enter into something like the business world, we enter into what is considered the commons. That is to say, we enter into a place that is no longer defined simply by our theological and Christian convictions. On the other hand, we still remain Christians as we are in business, and we retain the rights of Christians in terms of how we organize our businesses and how we do engage in terms of the business and economic worlds. But we also recognize that in this world there are limitations upon those religious and theological convictions whereby we can operate. There are anti-discrimination statutes that are obligatory upon all, and most of us would understand that in some, if not many of these cases, the principles are correct. But there are others where a moral issue is very clearly at stake, and never more clearly than is now the case with the issue of same-sex marriage. Where same-sex marriage has become legal, there have been judgments and are certainly arguments suggesting that those who have an objection to same-sex marriage on an explicitly Christian basis cannot extend that into the principles whereby they organize and operate their business. In other words, they cannot say, "I don't recognize a same-sex marriage ceremony, therefore I will not make a wedding cake for such a ceremony, or I will not serve as a wedding photographer for such a ceremony." We can understand that this is a very urgent issue. We can understand why the issue has found its way into legislatures, such as the legislature in Kansas. As the New York Times reported yesterday, a bill that would have allowed individuals to refuse to provide business services to same-sex couples in that state because of religious beliefs met a surprising and quick end when conservative senators sided with liberal advocates in saying that the measure promoted discrimination. Now, a very similar bill passed the House in Kansas by a vote of 72-49. That took place last Wednesday. And it also was expected to clear the state Senate very readily. Both the House and the Senate in Kansas are very solidly in Republican hands. But it didn't happen. It didn't happen because even as last year, the legislature passed what was known as the Kansas Preservation of Religious Freedom Act, even some conservative senators, very clearly identified with Christianity in Kansas, came to the determination that the law that was considered last week, at least by the Senate, was simply too broad. It allowed too much discrimination, and discrimination that wasn't explicitly upon religious grounds. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, yesterday's edition of the Nashville paper, the Tennessean, reported that Tennessee lawmakers are taking up a bill that would let cake makers, florists, and other vendors refuse service to same-sex couples who wish to marry, even if the state's constitutional ban on gay marriage is struck down. As reporter Chas Sisk explained, a Senate panel scheduled to debate a measure this week meant to give businesses the explicit power to turn down same-sex ceremonies if they contradict, quote, sincerely held religious beliefs, end quote. Well, that bill comes as courts and legislatures throughout the country have been legalizing same-sex marriages, in some cases striking down state bans. And we would note, even as this reporter explains the story in this way, the very close proximity state of Kentucky, right on Tennessee's northern border, has just had a federal judge last week ruled that at least part of that state's amendment against same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. Meanwhile, later last week, as we discussed yesterday, a federal judge in Virginia also handed down a decision nullifying that state's ban on same-sex marriages as unconstitutional. Even though that federal district court judge put her decision on hold, it still sent a very urgent signal to other states, including states like Tennessee. So in Kansas, the legislature last year passed a religious freedom protection bill that was considered to be not broad enough. Meanwhile, the bill that was proposed this year has fallen in the state Senate because even some conservatives felt that it went too far. Here in Tennessee, a very similar measure is now being taken up. And you can see that this kind of bill that was inconceivable because it was not at all needed just a matter of a few years ago, is going to be hotly debated in many state legislatures and will almost surely find its way into hot debates before judges as well. One very ominous paragraph in the story in the Nashville paper reads like this, and I quote, "The bill is unlikely to affect clergy or religious organizations, both sides in the debate say. Under the First Amendment, they cannot be compelled to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies," end quote. What is so remarkable about that paragraph? It's not what it says, it's what it doesn't say. In other words, the big issue for many churches and religious organizations is not the question of whether they will be forced to perform same-sex marriage ceremonies. To date, at least, no church in the United States of America has been legally compelled to perform any marriage ceremony whatsoever. That is a false issue. The issue is this: what marriages must churches and religious organizations be forced to recognize? That's a far more difficult question, and there are many who are trying to avoid that question or to evade it. But the reality is that the religious liberty of churches and religious organizations will be severely undermined if those churches and religious organizations are not free to recognize only those marriages that are understood to be theologically and biblically valid. The heart of the issue is this: do Christians surrender all of our Christian rights when we enter into the commons, specifically when we enter into the business sphere? The answer to that question must be no. Otherwise, religious freedom is an entire charade in this country. It is an illusion. On the other hand, we do recognize that there are some limits. But that's where the specific issue of marriage comes into view, along with the issue of an expressive vocation. First, the issue of marriage. Marriage is a unique institution. It is the privileged institution that is at the very heart of society. And when we understand the privileged and urgent nature of marriage, we come to understand that we are all making decisions about defining marriage based upon our worldview. For Christians, that worldview is explicitly based upon Scripture. And it is a violation, particularly on an issue like marriage, it is a violation of religious liberty and of theological conviction to force persons to recognize in an active way a marriage that is claimed by the state but is denied by Christian conviction. On the other hand, this is where the issue of an expressive vocation comes in. Now, you compare this with something like selling cars. If you have a car dealership, you sell cars to same-sex couples and to opposite-sex couples. You usually sell cars without any reference to marriage whatsoever. You sell cars to single people, and you sell cars without any regard to the sexual orientation of those who are purchasing a vehicle. It simply isn't a relevant matter. But if you're making a wedding cake, and it is a celebratory cake by its very definition, and there is an artistic element, then it is a matter of coercion that violates religious liberty to require someone who has an expressive vocation to express what they do not believe. Indeed, what they find both morally and theologically impossible. So to compel someone as a cake baker to make a cake to celebrate a same-sex wedding with a message likely to be written into the cake itself, to require a photographer to use the gift of photography with all of its expressive power to endorse by the very act of professional services a same-sex marriage, to require someone who might be creating a floral arrangement or any number of these services assorted together, to require them to recognize a same-sex marriage to the extent that they join in expressing it, that is a coercion. That is a violation of religious liberty. That is a violation of one of the most sacred commitments that the citizen should count upon from the state, that the state does not require the citizen to violate conscience. Finally, there's one other issue about this we simply have to note. Those who began pressing for the agenda of recognizing same-sex marriages and legalizing same-sex marriages often used the mantra of tolerance as the great moral axiom. But you'll notice that those who are now bringing anti-discrimination lawsuits against Christian florists and cake bakers and photographers and others are demonstrating that there is no tolerance coming from those who had previously called for it. We are a society large enough that virtually anyone looking for a photographer or a cake baker or anyone else offering those kinds of expressive services can almost surely find someone who, without any violation of conscience, would gladly offer the services. To demand that all offer the services is a demand that clearly violates religious liberty and the rights of every citizen. And this should trouble people on both sides of the issue. The fact that it doesn't tells us very quickly that all of these demands for tolerance only go one way. Next, if you're looking for evidence of what it means to live in a morally conflicted age, just look at recent headlines and papers, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Reuters News Service, and many others. The headlines have to do with the fact that the federal government is now issuing guidelines for banks as to how banks are to be involved in handling accounts for businesses dealing in marijuana. What's the issue? Well, the issue is this. It is illegal for banks to have anything to do with businesses that have anything to do with marijuana. But the federal government, recognizing that some states, including Colorado and California, have basically legalized marijuana, are now saying that even as marijuana remains a federal crime in terms of its use or possession, and remember, marijuana still is listed as a Class 1 controlled substance by the federal government, nonetheless, the federal government has come up with banking guidelines for how banks can properly act in what the federal government still claims is an illegal manner. In other words, this is almost right out of something like Orwell's book 1984. What we have here is the federal government saying, it's illegal for you to do this, but if you're going to do it, we're going to tell you how to do it most properly, even though it remains illegal. And remember, we're talking about the banking industry. As Sergey Kobolevsky of the New York Times reports, the Obama administration last Friday issued guidelines intended to give banks confidence that they will not be punished if they provide services to legitimate marijuana businesses in states that have legalized the medical or recreational use of the drug, even though it remains illicit under federal law. That's an amazing paragraph. So is this one. The policy, that is the policy promoted by the Treasury Department of the Obama administration, does not grant immunity from prosecution or civil penalties to banks that serve legal marijuana businesses, but it directs prosecutors and regulators to give priority to cases only where financial institutions have failed to adhere to the guidance. End quote. This is beyond bizarre. Here you have the Obama administration saying to the banking industry, if you have anything to do with the marijuana business, it's illegal and you should be prosecuted. But you won't be because we're going to tell our prosecutors not to prosecute you unless the illegal activity with which you will now be involved is undertaken over against the advice we give you about how to undertake this illegal activity. And how is the banking industry responding to this? Well, it comes down basically to the expression, thanks but no thanks. As Frank Keating, identified as the president of the American Bankers Association, said in a statement, while the banking industry appreciates the efforts by the Department of Justice and the Obama administration to offer guidance or regulation, he said that guidance or regulation doesn't alter the underlying challenge for the banks. What's he talking about there? Well, the underlying challenge is what the federal government now proposes that the banks do remains illegal by the very declaration of the federal government. Here's another paragraph in the New York Times article that should have our attention. I quote, legal marijuana entrepreneurs have stressed that access to banking has been their most pressing concern. Their businesses are conducted almost entirely in cash, raising huge security concerns because it is difficult for them to open and maintain bank accounts or to accept credit cards. Banks have been apprehensive about providing services to marijuana businesses for fear that the authorities might punish them for violating money laundering laws, among other federal statutes and regulations. End quote. All this points to an essential fact that we ought to note very carefully. This headlong rush to legalize marijuana represents a huge moral shift in the society. But as is so often the case, the law is well behind this moral shift. And furthermore, it's virtually impossible to imagine how the laws can now fully catch up with this moral shift. Furthermore, it tells us that the legalization of marijuana is a vast social experiment being undertaken by those who appear to have very little concern for the cost to the larger society. Perhaps we can summarize the fact that it appears that a bunch of baby boomers are absolutely determined to legalize the use of marijuana, no matter the cost to the larger society. And in this case, the banking industry once again, at least at this point, is saying, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want any part of this. If the federal government is essentially telling us how to do what's illegal in a way that's perhaps slightly less illegal. The ludicrous nature of this situation appears right on its face. And yet the federal government released these proposed guidelines in a very serious way, as if they should make sense. But to put it bluntly, these regulations will only make sense to those who are actually imbibing of the product that the federal government still says is quite illegal. Finally, we turn to the issue of education, and yesterday's edition of the New York Times had a front-page article entitled Common Curriculum Now Has Critics on the Left. It's a very interesting story, reminding us that education is never value neutral. Education always comes from some worldview. It always represents some worldview. Educational systems make sense according to some worldview. No education is ever morally or worldview neutral. It is impossible. It's never theologically neutral, for that matter. But what you have here in this article in the New York Times by Al Baker is the fact that evidently many people are surprised that there are new critics of the Common Core curriculum being pushed by the Obama administration. But in this case, the critics are found in New York, and they're not Christian conservatives. They're not people from the Bible Belt. They're people living in the Empire State, and they're people from the cultural left who are saying the Common Core standards simply have to go. Now, this is a very interesting development because the earliest critics of Common Core have come from the cultural right. Those who have been concerned that the Common Core curriculum standards reflect very liberal assumptions, and those who also complain about the federalization of the curricula of our schools, which had been, at least throughout most of American history, very much a matter of pride having to do with local control, local influence, local decisions over the curriculum. The federalizing of this curriculum is just another sign of the reach of big government. But as you see in this news story appearing in yesterday's edition of the New York Times, very much on the front page, there are now complaints from liberal parents and from liberal influencers in the society as well. They're making a very similar set of complaints. They're complaining that a mandated government standardized curriculum is not acceptable on the basis of their own worldview assumptions. Now, here is a very interesting development that reminds us, as we said, that education is never value neutral. So you have people on the right and on the left, liberals and conservatives, traditionalists and so-called progressives, who are complaining from equal and opposite ends of the political and ideological spectrum that the Common Core curriculums violate worldview. Now, again, this shouldn't really surprise us. It's surprising only if we haven't been following educational debates of the last several decades. For instance, many in America assume that the idea of homeschooling emerged from the cultural right, conservative Christians dissatisfied with the public schools, demanding the right to educate children in our own homes. But that is not how the homeschooling movement, at least in its modern form, really began. It began not in the Deep South, on the cultural right. It didn't begin in the state of Texas. It began in the Pacific Northwest. It didn't begin among conservatives. It began among liberals. Indeed, those who would be previously described as of the hippie generation, who didn't want their children, the children of the love generation, going to government schools they identified as the corporate schools of the man, under the control of the federal government. They demanded the right to withdraw their children from the public schools and educate them without what they identified as the government-directed and corporatist mentality of the public schools. Later, and on a much broader scale, conservative Christians and other traditional Christian parents in this country also came to the very same conclusion, but from the opposite end of the worldview spectrum. So why are we talking about this? Well, the point is very simple. A story like this, appearing in the New York Times, tells us what we already knew, but what many do not want to recognize. And that is that there is no such thing as a neutral education. Someone's deciding what is taught. Someone's deciding what is measured. Someone's deciding the standards of evaluation. Someone's hiring the teachers. Someone is setting the expectations. Someone wants the children going through this process to emerge with some very specific worldview. There are those on the right who have been long and properly concerned about this. There are those on the left as well. What do those on both ends of the spectrum agree upon? We agree that education matters and that education is never neutral. That certainly doesn't end the discussion about education in America, but it's a very good place to begin one. As I close, I ask you to remember our new program, Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question at the phone number 877-505-2058. Call with your question and your voice. That's 877-505-2058. Ask Anything Weekend Edition is released on Saturday mornings and archived at albertmuller.com, available on iTunes and other customary platforms. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmuller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Nashville, Tennessee, and I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.